Today is September 24th. It's the 24th of Elul. This is our class in Sefer Breshit in the context of the Milton program Shivim Panim. This is our fourth class, and according to the curriculum, we should be looking at verses that have to do with what God said to Noah after the flood, after Noah left the ark, and God renewed the covenant with him. And of course, we understand that this renewal of the covenant is equivalent to the creation of the world, because now the world is beginning again. It's born again. Just like Adam and Eve were the first men and women when there's no one before them, so Noah and his wife are now the new beginning. And a brit is made, a covenant is made between the inhabitants of the world and the Creator, God. We are not going to focus on the specific verses that talk about the brit that the covenant wants us, that the curriculum wants us to look at. We're going to focus on different verses in the same context. The curriculum wanted us to spend the next hour on the matter of the rainbow as a sign of the covenant. And what can we do? I didn't find it too interesting. So we're going to do something else, which I find much more interesting. It's the same set of verses that the curriculum is focused on, but a completely different focus. And therefore, you can open up the folders if you want, but we won't be using them at all. By the way, who needs a folder? Okay. Two. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're going to focus rather on the verses in the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, which are found in chapter 9 after they leave the flood. We're not going to start with those verses because in order to understand them, and I'm not even telling you what they say, in order to understand these verses, we have to really go back to the beginning. Go back to Perek Aleph, to chapter 1 of Bereshit that we looked at a few weeks ago. And we'll focus there on a number of verses that will serve as the backdrop and the foil to the verses that come after the flood. I don't actually. I gave out my last one. Is there any... Okay. So we are in source number 1 on page 1 of this handout, and you notice, I'll just say this parenthetically, my daughter's name at the top of the page. The reason my daughter's name is here is because this particular collection of sources was not put together by me, but rather by myself and my daughter together in preparation for her bat mitzvah 9 years ago. These verses turn out to be from Parshat Noach, from the second Torah portion of the book of Genesis, and that's when she was born. So going back, like I said, 9 years ago to 1998, even 10 years ago, here we go. We're beginning in chapter 1, verse 27 of Bereshit. A little bit of the Hebrew, then a lot of the English. Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo. So God created man in his own image. B'tzelem Elokim bara oto. In the image of God, he created him. Zahar unkeva bara otam. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it and have dominion. Three different verbs there. God said that he wants us to kibshuha, to conquer it, or dgu, or do, and to have dominion, and to fill it up, umilu et ha'aretz. So it's replenish, it's subdue, it's have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves on the earth. We'll have to ask ourselves, one of the central questions will be as we begin, are there any limits to that subjugation, to that dominion? Or is it across the board without any restrictions? And God said in verse 29, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree on which is the fruit-yielding seed to you, it shall be for food. So, right, well, we already took them in the previous class. I gave it away. The truth is, says Beverly, that verse 29 contains an implicit restriction vis-a-vis verse 28. Verse 28 says, be fruitful, multiply, replenish, subdue, have dominion. It's all true. But how far does that go? It goes only as far as using all these things while they're alive, but not killing them. Because verse 29 says, everything is given to you as food. No, it's not. Only every herb bearing seed, every tree, all the fruit is given to you as food in verse 29, which implies unequivocally. It's not something that we can figure out. It might be wrong, it might be right. It's unequivocal in verse 29 that only the plant kingdom is given to man as food, which means the animal kingdom is not. So you're allowed to use oxen to plow. And you're allowed to do all different types of things, as we'll talk, with the milk and with the fleece of animals. But to kill them for food, apparently not. And it goes further, that verse 30 says that the same restrictions put upon human beings are also put upon animals, as it were. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for food, and it was so. So the animals also were created in some ideal sense to be vegetarians. Now, as we talked in the past, I don't necessarily take this literally. I believe, my personal belief, that it's true, but I don't necessarily believe that it's historically true. I believe that it has a truth here. It's coming to teach a message. There's a musar, there's a point to it. There are certain principles and philosophically overarching ideas that are here. And I believe there's a truth. They might not be literally true, which means they might not be historically true. It might not be that these things happened a certain number of years ago. But it's a story meant to teach a message that I believe is true. So, I don't know if there ever was a time in history when the animals were really vegetarians. But the idea is, in some ideal sense, God would like a world in which animals and human beings don't kill each other. And that's something to strive for. Yeah. Before we go on to the point of today's class, which is about how this law was changed and altered and revised after the flood, before we get to that, we just have to clear away some little obstacles and minefields in understanding what's written here. And the first minefield comes from what I photostated at the bottom of the same piece of paper, source 2. This is already in chapter 3 of the book of Bereshit, in chapter 3, verse 21. For the man also, and for his wife, did the Lord God make coats of skins and clothe them. God made skins and clothing. Now you might say, wait a second, how could that be? Because we're not allowed to eat animals, can't kill them. How can we have pocketbooks and clothing and stoles made of animal fur and skin?
They die naturally.
So, very good. It might be that they die naturally. Might be that they died naturally. Or it could be that God killed them. God's allowed to kill. Perhaps that human beings aren't. It said God made for human beings this clothing of skins. And I'll just point out one other possibility. This is found in ancient Midrash from the land of Israel from 1,800 years ago, Pirkei the Rabbi Eliezer, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, which says that God made these pieces of clothing from the skins of the one animal you don't have to kill in order to take its skin.
Snake.
From the shed skin of a snake. Because according to Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, God, even God, wouldn't kill an animal, and even wouldn't use the skin of an animal that died of natural cause. Even God wanted to work according to the rules of complete respect for living creatures, and God only took the skins from the serpent. very suggestive.
Rabbi?
Yes.
But didn't God create Adam and Eve naked, and they're the ones that wanted clothing? God didn't really intend for them to have clothing, right?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. That it's only after the sin that they found the need for clothing. Okay.
Okay. So they didn't wear big ones?
At the beginning?
Weren't they leaving the garden, so they might be going into a different climate?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, cold?
Yeah, could be. Hell. It could be.
I don't know.
Could be. Depends how far they wandered. In any case, let's go on now to the next source on the back of the same page. This is source 3. And here's another little minor bump in the road before we actually get to the major point of contrasting the verses in Genesis 1 to what happens after the flood. This little bump says, it's 4:1, chapter 4, verse 1 and verse 2. And the man knew Chava, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have acquired a man-child from the Lord. And she again bore his brother Hevel, and Hevel was a keeper of sheep. And you might say, how could Hevel be a keeper of sheep if God said that we're not allowed to eat the animals? But it's simple, of course. He kept the sheep without killing them, but rather for their fleece, which just reinforces for us that man is meant to have dominion over the animals. We're not meant to be equal. But within that dominion, there's a limit. You're allowed to use them. You're supposed to, you can herd them. You can do all these things, plow with them, but you can't kill them. That's easy.
Sacrifice.
But then Beverly says, wait a second.
That's the big problem.
That's the big bump in the road. The fact that they had clothing from animal skins doesn't so much bother us. The fact that Hevel, the kind, excuse me, was a keeper of sheep doesn't bother us. But the next verses say that there were sacrifices from the animal kingdom. And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to the Lord, and Hevel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat parts, and there's the best parts thereof. And the Lord had respect to Hevel and to his offering. We don't know what that means, that God had respect, that God accepted it, but God accepted an animal sacrifice. Man did it, and God said, great, keep up the good work. And wait a second, how do we deal with this? This is really hard. Anyone have any suggestions? I don't have a good answer, by the way. So don't, you know, sit on pins and needles. I'm asking you for your help. I have two possibilities, but...
Well, isn't it like other times that God found that he made a mistake or he did something incorrectly and then he corrected it?
Can you elaborate?
Or he changed his mind?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I mean, are there other examples? Aren't there lots of other examples?
Mm-hmm. Let me think about that a second. Mm-hmm. I don't have to say, because you're right, but the verses only say later that God changed his mind. It hasn't been said yet. In fact, it hasn't been said yet. It's hard to, and it's going to be said, but it applies already here. I think that's difficult, but, you know. Okay, another suggestion?
Well, and, you know, as we said in another place, God gave man the ability to do his work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what man chose to do.
Yeah, but here it's in direct contradiction to the Torah. We're allowed to interpret and do God's work in a framework of the law, but to break the law and have God sanction the breaking of the law? That's hard. That's hard.
They're outdoing each other.
The two boys.
And yet it was accepted, so that's a contradiction.
Jen?
We were explicitly told that we could only eat of the plants and not eat of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that we have dominion over all of them. They're not eating of this animal.
Mm-hmm.
They're not eating of it. They're giving this to God. So there's, I don't think, if I understand the text correctly, there's nothing explicit in the text up until now that would prevent this.
Very good. I'll ask you a question. Do you think I'm allowed to hunt for sport according to the first chapter of Genesis? I'm not
no.
going to eat.
But there's a, but I would say no.
No.
But I think there's an issue there of, there was something special about the nature of this offering,
mm-hmm.
of making the sacrifice. Sacrifice seems to be in a different category.
Yeah.
Than just doing something because it's fun.
Yeah. What Jan says is the opinion of Rabbi Abraham Yitzhak HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Cook, who claims that sacrifice, being that it's for God, actually does not do violence to the animal because it's allowing the animal to serve God through its death. Which is a development of what you said. And Leslie just said, ooh, I have the same reaction as Leslie. Right. I don't like it.
Well, I didn't say I liked it.
But I don't have a better answer.
I didn't say
right?
I liked it either.
Right.
But I mean,
right. Jan is saying that could be, logically, perhaps that could be the explanation. I don't have a better answer except for an application of the things we learned in the past. Because remember, I brought up the theory, the possible approach that was originally suggested in schematic form by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik and later developed by Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. I presented this approach that says that there are in the Torah different perspectives, different laws, different takes on and even on things that happened. And we saw that chapter 1 of Genesis, as opposed to chapter 2 and 3, are two different stories, two different realities, two different approaches, and the fact that they contradict what they're supposed to contradict is, we said, that's one theory of biblical understanding. If we take that approach, then we have no problem, because it could be that chapter 1 has the theory, the idea that man is meant to be a vegetarian, but perhaps chapters 2, 3, and 4 don't have that same approach. Perhaps chapter 4 here is a continuation of 3 and 4, of 3 and 2, which it is, which has a different approach, perhaps. And we don't have to ask the question, how do you make chapter 4 fit with chapter 1? Perhaps it doesn't have to fit. It's another possibility. Anyway, all of these are just bumps in the road. Still, it's clear to us with all the different questions that according to chapter 1, man was meant to be vegetarian. That's clear. And then we come to the verses that serve as the focal point for today's study in chapter 9 of Genesis after the flood. After everything was destroyed, everything in a sense is recreated, that Noah comes out of the ark with his wife, with his children, with one of each of the two sexes of all the animals. And then it says, this is the bottom of page 2 of our source sheet, chapter 9, verse 1 and 2 and 3 and henceforth. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth.
Oh, no, and here it says be fertile.
It's a different translation.
Yeah.
But what's clear is that this verse mimics word for word a verse we read earlier.
Yep.
Right? So if we go back to Genesis 1 and try and compare, it's hard because it's the same piece of paper, two different sides, but if you compare Genesis 9:1 to Genesis 1:28, you find the exact same thing. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth. We're going to get to that. In the Hebrew, it begins the same. There's a blessing, and it says, be fruitful and multiply, pru, or vu, and fill up the earth. Both in chapter 1 and chapter 9, the same Hebrew words, blessing, fruitful, multiply, and fill up the earth. Yes.
Could the difference be?
There is no difference.
No, well, I'm sorry. Before, when in chapter 1, no death had ever occurred. I mean, you know, we knew of no death.
Right.
So maybe could that have changed the force of nature? I mean, we know how to kill now, or
you're asking.
Killing implies.
So are you answering the question I didn't ask yet of why did God change things?
Yes. Maybe.
Okay.
What do you mean, maybe?
That's a wonderful question you asked.
Well, it's a good answer, but we have to get back to it. We have to do things orderly.
Okay.
But so in what we see here in chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, again, is the blessing, and then be fruitful and multiply and replenish. In the Hebrew, it's the exact same words. The blessing, the fruitful and multiply, and the replenish, the exact same Hebrew words. But then it says something different. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air, upon all that moves upon the earth and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. I'll stop there for a moment. In place of what it says in chapter 1, you subdue them and have dominion over them, here it says they're going to be afraid of you. Which I would think is one step further than dominion. In chapter 1, you control them, you rule over them, you subjugate them. But that doesn't mean that they're afraid of you. Here in chapter 9, man's dominion goes one step further. All the animals are quaking in their boots in the presence of man. Why? What has changed? It's the next verse. The next verse says,
Eat them,
right. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. That phrase, even as the green herb have I given you, in other words, that harks back to Genesis 1. Just like in Genesis 1, I gave you every green herb, now I'm giving you everything that moves, just like I had given you the green herbs. God is expanding our menu. Right?
But then is it a contradiction, or is it that God changes his mind?
God changed his mind.
Every moving thing?
God changed his mind. And you already decided to answer the question, why God changed his mind. But first we have to establish that God changed his mind. God changed his law. So let's just see, we'll read a little bit more, verse 5 and 6, and then we'll talk about why the change occurred. And surely, your blood of your lives will I require. In other words, that's capital punishment. You have to give your blood. When? At the hand of every beast will I require it. And at the hand of man. At the hand of every man's brother will I cry the life of man. Whoso sheds blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God, man, image of God made
him man.
This is a limit on the violence that God has allowed in the previous verse. In the previous verse, God allowed violence, the spilling of blood. You can eat animals. But God says, there's a limit to that. Human beings cannot be killed. Neither by animals nor by man. That's against the rules. Whoever does it is going to pay. And it makes sense that the minute God allows violence, well, violence has a tendency to propagate itself and has to be limited. And indeed it's limited.
What I meant before with every moving thing, that's not really the case. Because once the laws of kashrut came in, we weren't allowed to eat every living thing.
You're right.
And there was this.
You're right, but at this point...
That's particularistic, whereas this is universalistic.
Right, this is before the Torah is given.
Right.
This is before the Jewish people. And every living thing, including the reptiles and the lobsters and the... and the snakes, and the zebras, yeah, and the giraffes, and the horses, and the pigs, everything is allowed for food. Except for your fellow man. Right? That's what it says. That's what it says. Okay. Indeed, we have to ask ourselves the question, why did this change in the law take place? And it's going to be a little bit difficult to go through the process here because I already gave it all away, at least one opinion, in the previous class. But let's look at the material. Okay.
I realized it didn't work.
You said it didn't work.
Because they were going to do it anyway.
Because they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, so you might as well put boundaries and limits and control what the human impulse is going to be.
Even though you weren't in the last class, it's pretty clear to you. So, what we have to do, therefore, is take note of the fact that it didn't work. That the pristine ideal of no violence between man and animals, animals and man and man, that you only destroy, as it were, the plant kingdom for our food. And of course the plant kingdom, no, take that back. It didn't work. How do we know it didn't work? Well, first of all, we all know that within a short time after creation there was a murder, fratricide, right? Brothers. We have that in the verses here. There's no need to read them again. We all know the verses, that one brother killed another. Not only that, there are other murders recorded at the beginning of creation. If we turn now to the third page, I might have photostated things in a poor order here, but if we turn not to the third page, but to the fifth page, it says at the top, source 8. Source 8. Source 8, which is Genesis chapter 4, verse 23. Genesis chapter 4, verse 23. And Lamech said to his wives Adah and Silai, "Hear my voice, wives of Lamech, hearken to my speech. For I have slain a man for wounding me, and a young man for my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold." There's a certain type of poetic lyricism here. Not everything is clear, but what is clear is he has slain a man. He's actually a little bit proud of it. Murder, second murder. And there are other indications in the Torah that things didn't go well for God with the little experimental creation that he made, because people were killing each other. There was violence. There was thievery. Let's read on the same page here what I called source 9 from Genesis 6, verse 5 and henceforth. The exact same page in the handout. Genesis 6, verse 5 and henceforth. These are the verses that come right before the flood, right before the deluge. "And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that all the impulse of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." We'll skip to verse 11. Looking for the place? It's okay?
Yeah, where?
This is in the source sheet. It says source 8 at the top of the page. And we're now in the source 9 at the second half of the page. And we're in source 9, which is chapter 6 of Genesis, verse 11. The last bracket. "The earth also was corrupt before God. And then it says, and the earth was filled with violence. Hamas. Hamas in Hebrew is violence. Violent crime. "And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. For the earth is filled with violence through them." Violence, violence, corruption. It's a bad place to live. And God's experiment has failed. He destroys the whole thing and then tries again with Noah and his wife and his sons. And when God tries again, the rules of the game are changed. Right? The rules of the game are changed. So, why the rules of the game changed? Why is man allowed to eat meat? So we've talked a lot about different possibilities in this class a little bit, a few minutes ago. In the previous class, we discussed it more. I want to look now at the source that I mentioned in the previous class. We're going to read it now inside, Rabbi Yosef Albo. Rabbi Yosef Albo, 15th century, Spain, one of the last, just about the last major Jewish thinker of the Golden Age of Spain. Because when he died, in the middle of the 15th century, it was only 50 years before the expulsion from Spain and the riots and the pogroms and the persecution was getting worse and worse. He was the last major Jewish thinker of the Golden Age of Spain. And Rav Yosef Albo is in our booklet here on pages 3 and 4. Pages 3 and 4. So it's at the top, page 3. It's the second piece of paper in the handout. Everyone find it? Anyone have a problem? So this source, I love this source. It's unbelievable to think that it was written 500 years ago. It's just so relevant, and you see, it's all, even more relevant than you might think. So this is Sefer HaIkarim by Rav Yosef Alvil, Part 3, Chapter 15. By the way, the English translation I brought here is not my translation. It was already in the 1920s translated and published in 5 volumes here in the U.S. by the Jewish Publication Society. And even though it's out of print, it's worth getting to a used bookstore, a used book site. It is a fascinating book. The explanation of all this is, I think, as follows. In the killing of animals, there is cruelty, rage, and the accustoming oneself to the bad habit of shedding innocent blood. So Rav Yosef Alvil holds that killing of animals and eating of meat is wrong. The Torah doesn't like it. That's why it's forbidden, according to chapter 1 of Bereishit. It's a matter of cruelty, shedding innocent blood. And then he adds another objection to meat eating that we might not be able to relate to, but we'll just read it. But the eating of the flesh of some animals produces, besides, coarseness, ugliness, and stupidity. What he means is a certain theory that you are what you eat. And eating flesh causes the mind to become stuffed up, causes certain atrophy of the synapses. So take it or leave it.
The rules for kashrut. Some of the rules right. For what prohibits
that. Right, that's one explanation of kashrut. Let's go on. My next bracket you can see is in the second piece that I photostated, beginning with the words seeing. Where the bracket is. Seeing that Adam lived on plants like the animals, he, and he's talking about Cain, he thought that the spirit is the same in all and that all die alike. That's important. What he means to say is that God's command to have respect for animal life, just like you have respect for human life, that command led Cain astray. It led him to believe that there's no essential difference between man and animals. He didn't see the Tzelem Elohim, the divine image in man. He said, if God said we have to respect animal life, it must be that we're all equal, animals and men. And that led him astray. Therefore, he brought an offering of the fruit of the ground. Right? Not from animals. To thank God for the superiority he gave him over plants. Because he felt that plants, yeah, we're allowed to eat them, we can't eat animals, so we have superiority over plants, but not over animals. He did not bring an animal offering because he did not think that his superiority to them in the ability to till the ground was important enough to warrant bringing an offering. He saw that animals don't have the mind to till a field, they only have to do it as our servants, but he didn't think that was significant. And he certainly wouldn't kill an animal to serve God, so he only brought from the vegetable kingdom. His main offense, I'm skipping four lines next bracket, his main offense was that he did not think that man's superiority to the animals amounted to anything. Also, he thought that he was forbidden to kill the animals because they were like him and were subject to death like him. He saw no difference between men and animals. For this reason, envy took hold of Cain and killed Abel. Just wait a second, we'll read more. For he still held the opinion that man is not superior to the animals. Look at this next line. Therefore he said to himself, since God favors Abel in his present, it is clear it's permitted to kill animals, and hence it is just as lawful to kill Abel as any other animal. I don't necessarily read this as pshat. I don't read it, that is to say, as a straightforward, plausible interpretation of the verses about the murder of Cain and Abel. Perhaps yes, perhaps no. But as a philosophical insight, it's astounding. Mm-hmm. It's astounding. Mm-hmm. So it's really amazing. Just let me just say one more sentence. I just want to make sure we understand. He's claiming that vegetarianism, as important, as divine, as wonderful, as true, as required as it was, vegetarianism has a downside. It might cause some people to misunderstand and to blur the boundaries between human beings and animals, to miss the point that man has a Tzelem Elohim, has a divine image, and the animals don't. That's what his point is. And if you blur those boundaries, then once you see that killing animals is okay, because God accepted the offering of your brother, then there's no reason not to kill the animal next to me. Prophets have a name, and he's my brother.
Where does it say that Abel gave the offering that he was dead, that the animal was dead? Could the animal have been alive?
Probably the Torah is talking about sacrifice as it was known in the ancient world. In the ancient world, the way you sacrifice an animal, the way you give it to God, was by burning it on the altar.
But it was the first sacrifice, so there was no other,
Well, again, I don't take the story literally. It's my opinion. I take it and as a story told to explain certain meta-truths, great truths. I think it's hard to take literally because you'd ask, who did Cain and Abel marry? Right. There are millions of other people. If it's a story about, like I said, meta-truths, and I assume the story is based upon the assumptions of ancient society, a sacrifice, we know what it means. Mm-hmm. Just look in the archaeological records.
God sort of fanned the flames of envy. He already knew there was evil in Cain's heart. And he didn't tell Cain, I don't like your offering or something, do it. He just sort of told him he was evil.
I think that's last week's class. I didn't want to go back over that. I'm sorry. Okay. So, I'll just stop a minute and tell you that I've learned this source many times. I've always been struck by its insight. And yesterday morning, I just took a few minutes to Google a few words that came to mind when I read the source. What came to my mind was P-E-T-A.
Yep. Yeah.
You're probably just talking about that, right, among yourselves?
Right.
I just want to read to you a number of things I saw. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is P-E-T-A. There's another group called the ELF, Earth Liberation Front. Another group called SHAC, Stop Hunting Done. I don't know what hunting done is. Stop Hunting Done Animal Cruelty. And these groups, among other things, have harassed and attacked fast food restaurant executives and laboratory resources, even injuring them in certain cases. And listen to the following. In the year 203, the PETA president, Ingrid Newkirk, wrote Yasser Arafat pleading with him to make certain that no animals are harmed in Palestinian suicide bombing attacks. In addition to that, PETA proclaimed in a 2003 exhibit that chickens are as valuable as Jewish Holocaust victims.
Oh, what is wrong with these people? They didn't evolve.
They don't get it.
So
they don't get it.
But let's point out that I would personally, my personal opinion, I would judge favorably and say that these people have it right, but they have it wrong. There's a deep instinct for justice and for divinity and for goodness behind this, but it has become perverted. Right. It's exactly what Rav Yosef Alba was talking about. It's a good thing, according to the Torah, to refrain from eating meat, to show respect for the animals, not to kill them, not to shed innocent blood. But that can't lead us down the slippery slope of erasing the distinctions between man and animals. Okay, so what does God do when he finds such a situation that his commandment to refrain from eating animals has caused some people at least to fall down, to roll down, to tumble down this slippery slope? So let's read on in Rav Yosef Alba. We're at the bottom of the page. Then when God revealed himself to Cain and announced his punishment for the crime of killing his brother, Cain did not yet understand that to shed the blood of a human being is a more serious matter than to shed the blood of an animal. But he thought that as he was punished for shedding human blood, so he would be punished for shedding animal blood. since Adam was not permitted to eat to kill animals, for the spirit of man, the spirit of the beast are alike. As the one dies, so does the other. This erroneous opinion remained among the descendants of Cain. Read on, next bracket. But the opinion of Cain was widely prevalent among his descendants, and hence the earth was filled with violence. As what causes violence? The divine ideal. The divine ideal of not eating animals, what causes, in a certain sense, violence, according to Rav Yosef Albo. One of the causes, and we saw it again from the Peta material. Was filled with violence on their account, their belief being that man has no superiority over the animal and might is right. Therefore, they were corrupt and lived like animals. For this reason, it was decreed that their name should be wiped out from the earth in the flood. When they were all destroyed, only Noah and those with him in the ark remained. God wanted to eradicate this opinion. Because when God recreates the world after the flood, he has to do something to fix this possible slippery slope. So we skipped 10 lines to the next bracket. He hastened to permit the killing of animals and the eating of the flesh. As the green herb have I given you all, we read that verse. You can eat the animals just as earlier you can only eat the green herb. The meaning is that as even Cain admitted that man is superior to the plants, since they were created for man, so all the animals are also for the sake of man who is superior to them, and there is not the same spirit in all. For this reason, he prohibited the shedding of human blood, giving as a reason the spirit of man is not like the spirit of the animal. You're allowed to shed animal blood. You're not allowed to shed human blood. For in the image of God made he man, man is a rational form which is nobler than the spirit of the animal. For this reason, it was necessary to permit all animals without distinction, which he did, which God did, in order to eradicate the former opinion and wipe off its memory. So that means that according to Rabbi Yosef Albo, it's wrong to eat meat, but God allows it anyway. Because doing the right thing, not eating meat, causes many, many, many problems that God had not foreseen, as it were. God is the divine parent who sees that he has to relax certain ideals for the betterment of his students, his children, his world. So God relaxes the prohibition against killing animals, even though God would not like us to eat animals, but he relaxes that prohibition because it had very, very deleterious and negative consequences. So again, relating to things we said in the previous class, this presents a theory of Jewish prudence, that the Torah sometimes allows things that it would not like to allow. Mm-hmm. It compromises. It makes concessions.
Giving into the human weakness.
Right. In a certain, because God, in a certain sense, has no choice. God is bound by human nature, and he has to find a way to work with human nature. God never changes human nature. He finds a way to work with it educationally, pedagogically. And sometimes a teacher has to water down his message, water down his standards. His parent has to water down what he demands from his children, her children, in order to reach the final goal eventually. Rabbi Yosef Albo continues, but when the Torah was given to Israel, right, 1,000 years later, or 1,000,000 years later, whenever it might be, but when the Torah was given to Israel, and the opinion in question had been wiped out, right, at this time people knew very well the distinction between man and animals, because we had been eating meat for thousands of years, or millions of years, then when God gave the Torah, God prohibited certain animals which produce coarseness and ugliness of soul. There's a certain theory of why certain animals are forbidden, because they mitamtem et amoch, because they cause your spirituality to become sullied. That's not our subject. Nay, even the animals that were permitted were merely a concession to human lust and desire. In the same ways, the Israelites were permitted women taken in war. And I'll just say it quickly for those who weren't in the previous class. The Torah says in chapter 21 of Deuteronomy that on the battlefield, Jewish soldiers are allowed to engage in a certain restricted and elevated form of what I called rape. Others disagree with my definition. I called it rape, and we explained that on the battlefield in the ancient world, rape was a very, very, very common prevalent occurrence, considered to be completely normal and ethical, and the Torah wants to outlaw it, but it can't. It cannot outlaw it because it would be ignored. Any type of blatant, across-the-board outlawing of battlefield rape would be ignored, so the Torah allowed it in a restrict and elevated fashion. And the Talmud explains why the Torah acted in that fashion, because Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah spoke in response to the evil impulse. The Torah did not legislate its ideal, but it legislated a watered down from the ideal. It legislated the most restrictions that the Torah thought the society at that time would be able to handle. So it's a compromise, it's a concession.
Otherwise you're guaranteeing that the people are going to sin.
Exactly. Exactly. And that theory of Jewish prudence, that the Torah doesn't always require the ideal, but rather a compromise with the ideal, that theory of Jewish prudence is brought forth in the Talmud only concerning that specific matter of the captive in war. But Rav Yosef Albo, in the 15th century, applies it just as well to the eating of meat, to explain why the Torah relaxes its prohibition of eating meat. So basically, Rav Yosef Albo is saying that human beings have the desire to eat meat, the desire to kill, the desire for domination, the desire for to overcoming and dominating in the most visceral fashion. And it's not good. And the Torah would like to outlaw it completely. But the Torah cannot outlaw it completely. Cannot outlaw it completely because man has this desire, and he might disobey the law had the law completely prohibited meat eating. And furthermore, a complete prohibition of meat eating brings us down a slippery slope of blurring the boundaries between animals and men. And therefore the Torah compromises and allows meat eating after the flood for the ultimate betterment of humanity. What do I mean, the ultimate betterment? Because if we take this approach, that the Torah's law that allows meat eating is only a concession to human weakness, it's not the ideal, well, that means that the Torah perhaps someday will try to implement the ideal. And the truth is that that idea we find in the words of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, which will be another minute. Would anyone like to stop me and question or ask or disagree? Listen.
I don't know if I can phrase this properly. I have a hard time with God compromising. Okay, so now in another 500 years we'll have a whole new technology. Oh my goodness, we're going to interpret this in a different way. And it's our man's interpretation of what he's saying. And we're allowing people to say God compromised. Can't see God as a compromising soul. I mean, it just doesn't fit my image of what is this who I'm supposed to emulate or work towards being, to be godly like, godlike.
I understand.
Yeah.
Let's say that I have a 5-year-old child who asks me some difficult questions. She might ask me, what is God? She might ask me, where do babies come from? She might ask me, why did Grandpa die? As a good parent, do I want to tell her the full truth and nothing but the truth? And obviously, for her own good, I don't want to lie. But I also cannot tell her the full truth because she won't understand the word I say.
She's not ready.
She's not ready. And I, as a parent, have to find a way to compromise without compromising the truth. I have to find a way to say something that's not false, that has in it the kernel of truth, that will lead her to the truth as she gets older. I'll say something if I'm a good parent. I'm not saying I am a good parent. But I'll say something that will remain with her for many years. She'll understand as a 5-year-old. She might understand it differently as a 10-year-old, differently as a 15-year-old. It'll stay with her. It'll grow with her. So was I a bad parent by not telling her the full truth? I don't think so. Obviously not. The same thing goes, not just an area of answering philosophical questions, but in the answer in the area of behavior and restrictions. I won't always demand of my children what I want to demand of them. Right? I might want to say, depending on the culture you're in and the land you're in, I might want to say that I absolutely forbid my children to take drugs and to smoke cigarettes and to drink alcohol. But there might be cases in which I know that my child's going to go to a party with his beer drink. I'm going to allow it, even though I don't want to allow it. Because I ultimately believe that if I forbid it, he's going to do it anyway. Yeah. Or it will rip him asunder from his society and his friends and and that won't work either. So at certain times I have to compromise. And the Torah says that the best parent is when it knows how to reach his or her goal in the end through all different types of temporary compromises along the way. And why do I say that's the best parent? Because that's God.
Okay.
Because that's God.
So then, all right, so what is God's goal? You said there's temporary compromises along the way, and I understand the analogy with, teenagers and drinking. So then, with the meat or the animals, what is God's ultimate goal that there are these compromises along the way?
Get us back. To make us realize we have to go back.
Right. In the case of meat eating, it's simple because the Torah begins in the first chapter of Genesis with the ideal, which would seem to indicate that through the course of human society and history, whether it's 1 million years or 5 million or 10 million or however many, we want to return to the pristine state of vegetarianism, but only when society is ready and not too soon. Because if you do it too soon, you have the same problems that led to the flood. Right? So it's a matter of understanding when and how, at what stage. We can look right now at the book of Isaiah. The clock says, look at it. And see that it looks like the ultimate ideal is vegetarianism as we have it before the flood of creation. So we'll read the last page of the booklet here, and we'll go back to Rav Kook. The last page of the booklet, it's at the top, Yeshayahu, Isaiah. For out of Zion, it's chapter 2, verse 3. For out of Zion shall go forth Torah, and the word of the Lord from Yerushalayim. And he shall judge among the nations, and he shall decide among many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So the reason I brought that was to say that when will there be vegetarianism, as we read on? Only when human beings no longer eat human beings. Eat, I mean figuratively. No longer kill human beings. Then we'll be able to reach the level of also not killing animals. Then and only then, not sooner. Now Isaiah 65, verse 25. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. In other words, wolves will no longer kill lambs. The animals will go back to Bereshit 1. And the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt nor destroy on my holy mountain, says the Lord. And perhaps not hurt or destroy means not only hurt or destroy themselves, but also not hurt or destroy us. The animals will become tame as an ideal. And then, Isaiah 11, verse 6, the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. There'll be no animosity, as it were, between human beings and the animals, because neither will kill the other for food. At least that's one possible interpretation. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together. and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the suckling child shall play in the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the viper's nest. Again, harmony. They shall not hurt nor destroy nor let my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. As an ideal. To reach over the course of thousands upon ten thousands of years, the idea being that the permission to eat meat is actually a step towards this. It's a step towards, not a step away. It's a step towards this because it allows us to redirect our energies of violence to the animals so that at least in one sphere, vis-a-vis human beings, we will learn to, we'll be able to control ourselves and not kill other human beings. As we direct our violent energies toward the animals and therefore learn towards human beings to develop a civilized society, a civil society that allows us to strengthen our inner moral reserves so that eventually we'll be able to expand that moral feeling, moral relationship to the animals as well. That's the theory that is presented by Rav Kook. And I want to end with Rav Kook. So two or three or four minutes, that's good. To end with Rav Kook. We'll read as much as we can read. And I recommend to read at home the rest. Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, his words can be found. Goodness, this is all mixed up here, this booklet.
Number 7 or number
7? I'm lost myself.
Oh, I think you're... It's just the Xerox is wrong. It starts on page 6, I think, and then goes 7.
All right. It starts on page 6 and goes...
Which are physically
Source 11. Source 11, right. Source 11. Source 11. The free movement of the moral impulse to establish justice for animals generally and their claim of their rights from mankind are hidden in the natural psychic sensibility in the deeper layers of the Torah. What that means is, in the depth of the Torah, it wants justice for animals. Don't kill them. But that's only in the depths. It's only in the ideal as set forth in Bereishit 1. In the ancient value system of humanity, while the spiritual illumination, which later found its bastion Israel, was diffused among individuals without involvement in the national framework, before nations were differentiated into distinct speech forms, the moral sense had risen to a point of demanding justice for animals. The first man had not been allowed to eat meat. In other words, at the very beginning, the ideal was in force. No meat eating. As is implied in God's instruction to Adam, I have given you every herb-yielding seed which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree in which there is fruit of a tree-yielding seed, it shall be to you for food. But when humanity, in the course of its development, suffered a setback, was unable to bear the great light of its illumination, the illumination of complete justice and morality, weren't able to bear that, weren't able to hold it, its receptive capacity being impaired, it was withdrawn from the fellowship with other creatures. Human beings were withdrawn from the fellowship with other creatures, were allowed not to kill them, over whom it excelled with firm spiritual superiority, because we have the divine image. Now it became necessary to confine the concern with justice and equity to mankind. So the divine fire, burning with a very dim light, that is the fire of justice and morality, which was dim in our hearts. There was enough fire, enough concern with justice to spread out to all, because we were killing each other. God had to limit that fire, that light, that morality, only to other human beings. So the divine fire, burning with a very dim light, might be able to warm the heart of man, which had cooled off as a result of many pressures of life. We didn't have enough moral strength to spread it out among all. God limited it and said, the moral strength you have, limit it to your brother, other human beings. The changes in thought and disposition, in the ways of particularized developments, require that moral duty, to turn backwards, require that moral duty be concentrated in the plane of humanity alone. Now, we'll just read the very last paragraph that we're continuing. I didn't say clearly. We'll read on where we are and just read this paragraph. Listen to this. But the thrust of the ideals in the course of their development will not always remain confined. In other words, God says Rav Kook, that eventually the ideals of full justice will be expanded to the whole animal kingdom, as we saw in the book of Isaiah. Just as the democratic aspirations will reach outward through the general intellectual moral perfection, when man shall no longer teach his brother to know the Lord, for they will all know me, small and great alike. Rav Kook believes in the evolution of human knowledge, democracy, understanding, study. So will the hidden yearning to act justly towards animals emerge in the future at the proper time. Not too soon, not too late. There'll be an evolution, I use that word on purpose, an evolution towards a higher morality going back to Bereishit 1. And then he says, what prepares the ground for this state, for this return, this evolution towards the higher level, is the commandments, the mitzvot. Those intended specifically for this era of concern. And to summarize what he says in the continuation, he goes on to say that the mitzvot of kashrut are designed to sensitize to us to the problematics of meat eating, so that we'll all be a little bit more careful, a little bit more concerned, a little bit more reticent about eating meat, and eventually, over the course of many, 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 many lifetimes of keeping kashrut, claims Rav Kook, we'll be sensitized to such a level that we'll be ready to stop eating meat completely. Shana tova to everyone.